This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1, 3, and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome back in, hour number three of Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Elijah Campbell here with you on this Thursday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. The NFL, the Tennessee Titans, Atlanta, everybody still in Julio Jones watch. And to help us talk more about that, we go to our 102.5 The Game phone line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com and welcome in Michael Rothstein, who covers the Falcons for ESPN. Michael, what's going on? Appreciate you taking time to join us this morning.
Oh, no problem. I'm just following Joe Rexroad from Michigan to the South. That's just really my goal in life.
That's a dangerous thing to do, my friend.
It's. I mean, come on, man. Like, right? I mean, who needs this cold weather crap? It's about time, Michael.
It took a while, but yeah, it happened. I mean, I finally decided I wanted to play golf year round. I mean, that's really what this was all about.
But I think the hard part must have been no longer being able to follow along with the glorious franchise known as the Detroit Lions. How are you going to cope with that, Michael? Not covering wonderful franchise.
As I was telling Elijah in the break there, I really just feel like I'm moving from trade to trade because I think the last time I spoke with y'all, if I'm remembering correctly, we were talking about Matthew Stafford and him
That's
moving
right.
from Detroit to ended up being Los Angeles. And that was really one of the last big stories I covered about the Lions. And then I get to Atlanta, and I think it was like, 3 weeks after I got, hey, guess what? Julio Jones might be leaving. And it's like, okay, here we go again. What's an offseason?
Right.
That's a great question. So, Michael, what's it been like? What's it like right now in Atlanta with Julio watch going on? And what do you think of this situation right now for the Falcons? What do you think Atlanta wants in return for Julio Jones? And what is realistic to get if you're the Falcons?
Right, and listen, there's been a lot of reporting a lot of places, right, about different things. I think ideally they would want, as my colleagues at ESPN have reported, ideally they'd want a first-round pick. But I have to believe, and again, this is just me. This is just me speculating. This is just me throwing this out there. If they had a true, like, hard first-round pick offer, one would think that Julio Jones would already be somewhere else. Because the point of all of this when it comes to trading Julio Jones doesn't have much to do with necessarily his ability. It has to do with two things. One, which we have since learned in the last week or so, apparently Julio Jones asked for a trade, and that kind of pushed things forward. And the second part is the Falcons have no money. And you can't operate if you don't have any money, at least under the salary cap. And right now the Falcons can't sign their rookie class. So they need to create money. And with what they've already done to get even close to the cap, which was restructure Matt Ryan, restructure Deion Jones, have Dante Fowler and Tyler Davison take pay cuts, restructure Jake Matthews, they already had to do a lot. So there's basically two high-value guys that they can now do something with, Julio Jones and Grady Jarrett. Grady Jarrett, theoretically, they could restructure or try to sign to an extension because he's in that extension window, and he's a guy I think that can be a cornerstone for this franchise going forward. Or they can do something with Julio Jones, which would be trade or restructure. And Terry Fontenot has made it clear he doesn't want to restructure everybody because that's how you just keep kicking that can down the road. And he was with the Saints, and the one team in the worst cap situation the Falcons right now are the Saints. So he knows all about what not to do in some ways, and I think he was trying to avoid that. So they need to do something to make cap room, and trading Julio Jones seems like the decision that they have more or less made. Now, what they actually get, who knows? I mean, I would imagine they can get something. I think there's going to be enough teams that maybe would have some interest that they can maybe leverage some sort of decent deal, but it's tough to really say right now. There's a lot of people saying a lot of things, but until something actually happens, as I learned with the Matthew Stafford situation, you don't truly know exactly what's going on.
So, Michael, your excellent colleague, Kimberly A. Martin, I think it was yesterday, reported that she believes the Ravens and Rams are out on this right now. There's been kind of a growing buzz out there, you know, that the Titans look better and better as, you know, as a potential trade partner here. And, I mean, obviously that makes sense with some of the familiarity between the staffs and things like that. But do you get the sense that this is sort of a standoff right now, that the Falcons, like, just don't have the offer they like, and that maybe other teams are like, you know what, I'm not coming to you either, so maybe we could be sitting and talking about this for a while?
Possibly, because there's also no impetus to get this done, like, today, right? I mean, other than for people like me who would love to have it done today.
Yes, exactly.
Done, right, you know, and from the sense I get from the fan base, is the fan base, if this is going to happen, they would like it to happen sooner rather than later so they can kind of move on with their lives as well, because Julio Jones in Atlanta is a franchise icon. He's one of the best players in franchise history and someone who is very well-liked within the city and within the fan base. So I think if it's going to happen, they want it to just kind of happen. And you know, I hate to go back to the Stafford thing again, but that was a week-long thing, and they really – you know, the Lions could have dragged that out for 2, 3, 4 weeks if they wanted to, really all the way up until that March deadline. So when you look at deadlines, really the deadline for the Falcons is right around the start of training camp, because guys are going to participate in mandatory minicamp next week anyway. They sign waivers for that. Like, that's that they've been practicing during these OTA periods anyway. So as long as, you know, they really have until July, because once training camp starts, kind of guys need their contract signed. So they can take this however long they want to. Now, it might behoove them to just get it done sooner rather than later, but if I'm the Falcons, I'm maybe not rushing so fast, and I'm waiting until after minicamp, and I'm waiting until after all of that is over, after all of everything is over, because maybe something happens with the team. Maybe a team sees something, and all of a sudden they're like, you know what, I really need Julio Jones. I'm going to up my offer. And that could be a scenario. And so if I'm Terry Fontenot, I don't love what I see out there, maybe I'm waiting. But again, I don't know. Terry Fontenot has been very tight-lipped about this entire process. Arthur Smith, if you've seen any of his press conferences the last couple of weeks, when myself and other reporters have asked about Julio Jones, you're not getting anywhere fast. So there's not a lot of information kind of coming out of Atlanta when it comes to exactly what's going on there.
Michael Rothstein on the line with us, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, covers the Falcons for ESPN. So, Michael, what does all of this mean for Matt Ryan? I mean, obviously, you still got Calvin Ridley there. You've just drafted Kyle Pitts. So it's not like you just don't have any weapons on offense. But Matt Ryan, getting up there in age, maybe start to looking towards the future if you're the Falcons at some point here. What does all this mean for Matt Ryan and his relationship with the Falcons as they move forward?
I don't think it's going to hurt Matt Ryan's relationship with the Falcons, but it certainly is going to put some pressure on Matt Ryan, I would think. I mean, yes, he still has Calvin Ridley. Yes, he still has Kyle Pitts. They still have Hayden Hurst, too, even though they didn't pick up his fifth-year option. He's still on the team this year. Russell Gage is a good receiver and I think can be a capable number two receiver. It's just that you're not going to have two number one receivers anymore if the Julio Jones trade ends up coming to pass. So if I'm Matt Ryan, I'm still looking around. I still have some good weapons, and I still have some good options. But to me, the thing with Matt Ryan is this. The Falcons very easily could have taken a quarterback at number four, and that would have put the clock on Matt Ryan, clearly. Probably a very quick clock, potentially. But the Falcons didn't do that. They also restructured Matt Ryan. So Matt Ryan is, I don't want to say he's safe, quote-unquote, because, I mean, there's only so much level of safety in the NFL unless you're Patrick Mahomes at this point. But you look at it and you say, okay, he's going to be their quarterback in 2021. There's a decent to good chance he's their quarterback in 2022, and you kind of then go from there. And at that point, he's, what, 37, 38 years old, and, you know, he probably has decisions to make as well. And his contract, I think, I believe he's going to 2023. So there's a bunch of questions at that point. And to me, if I'm Terry Fontenot and Arthur Smith, the way that the Matt Ryan situation has kind of unfolded, if things go south this year for the Falcons, right? Like, say things go horribly bad. Say they go Lions last couple of years bad, just to, you know, have bring back to kind of what I had covered before. You're probably blowing a lot of this up and kind of starting over with maybe a different type of nucleus, and that would require trading Matt Ryan or moving on from Matt Ryan. And at that point, maybe Matt Ryan would want to move on, much like Matthew Stafford did there. But if they show that they can be competitive and they maybe show that they can kind of keep things going, then maybe you stick with Matt Ryan and you take his replacement next year, the year after, or you do what the Titans did. You do what the Bucks have done. You do what some other teams have done in the past, which is build around what you have quarterback-wise, and then the quarterback comes last, and maybe it ends up being a veteran. Maybe it ends up being a guy who didn't have the best success one place and wants to go elsewhere. Or, as we're seeing more and more with Matthew Stafford, Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, guys are trying, especially quarterbacks, are trying to say, hey, I don't necessarily want to be here anymore, and sometimes they get moved. And maybe you build your team and make it nice and really kind of attractive enough, like Tom Brady in Tampa, where you get a high-end quarterback who wants to come there, and that's the last piece, versus the theory of building around the quarterback and he has to be your first piece.
All right, quick media question for you, Michael. How is Arthur Smith handling, you know, the head coach press conferences? I know this topic has got to be already annoying to him. Have you had the pleasure of talking with Dean Pease yet, and do you miss covering Taylor Lewan?
Oh, man, that's a lot of stuff. I have not talked with Dean Pease yet, but I hear wonderful about Dean Pease. I have not talked to Taylor Lewan since the last time the Lions and Titans played in Detroit. But it was very nice to talk with Taylor Lewan. I covered Taylor Lewan since he was a freshman in college at Michigan, and he has grown up a lot since then, and it's been awesome to kind of see him grow up and mature and have a podcast that's incredibly successful, which, honestly, Joe, you were in Michigan when he was there as well. That's like to the surprise of nobody that he is having a successful podcast. Like, right. That was just his personality. I mean, when he was 18... He had, you know, I don't know if he still has the finger mustache tattoo, but I'm never going to forget that because, like, he would sometimes come to press conferences and put it up to his nose. And, like, that's just the personality that he had. And it was refreshing and different at a place like Michigan where a lot of times guys are scared to say anything. And then Arthur Smith, he's handled press conferences fine. I mean, yes, I think he talked for like 16 minutes, and probably 13 minutes of it were Julio Jones questions. And it was like he was in the movie Dodgeball where, you know, you dip, dive, dodge, dip. I screwed up the reference, but
yeah, we get it.
that's basically what it was like. And he just was like private conversations. And you saw that again when I asked him about, because I asked him yesterday about, well, is Julio going to be at mandatory minicamp next week? That's the next logical thing. And he went to the private conversations thing. That's kind of his go-to right now, is private conversation is going to remain private, and he's just not really coming off of saying that. He's, I will say this, for a rookie head coach, he is very good at, I am staying on my message, I am not getting flustered or frustrated with any of that. And that to me has been impressive, because I've covered enough head coaches that if you kind of get to them enough and you ask them the question enough times, they say something they probably don't necessarily want to say. But Arthur Smith to this point has been very, very toe the line with all of that, and frankly it has been a little bit impressive that he's been able to do that so well, considering he's in, what, month four of being a head coach, month five of being a head coach, and hasn't had many press opportunities, and hasn't, if we're being honest, met any of the people that have covered, that are covering him because of COVID restrictions still. So he doesn't have any relationships with any of us yet, and that's part of it. But that was a long answer for he's doing fine so far.
Oh, great stuff, man. Michael Rothstein from ESPN has been our guest here on Robbie and Rex Road, covers the Atlanta Falcons all over the Julio Jones watch down there in Atlanta. Michael, really appreciate you taking time to join us this morning.
Hey, no problem. Anytime.
Absolutely. Thanks, we'll be back. We'll react a little bit to what Michael had to say there. Get back into the Julio Jones conversation. Taking your thoughts on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, 615-737-1025, 615-737-1025. This is Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Listen to The Game every weekday for your chance to win $1,000. It's The Game's 1K payday presented by Kentucky Kingdom and Hurricane Bay. Listen for keywords at 9, at noon, and at 3 o'clock. And when you hear it, go to thegamenashville.com and enter the keyword for a shot at $1,000. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road, here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Elijah Campbell here with you on this Thursday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. Our friend Gregory tweeting in this morning saying, he bought a Soviet Union Olympic basketball jersey off a sketchy website for $15. He can grow a mustache to reveal Chuck Norris. He is the most interesting radio producer who lives in a haunted house. We're talking, of course, about our own Elijah Campbell. Elijah, he's photoshopped your face on like the Dos Equis guy here from the commercials. It's an interesting resemblance here.
I look like Sacha Baron Cohen. It's exactly what that looks like. Apparently, if you give the Dos Equis guy my eyebrows and my nose, he turns into Borat.
So I don't know
if that's a good or bad thing for the Dos Equis guy, okay. But uncanny. It's the first thing I thought of. Greg's really good with this face app swap, and that's the first time that I've ever. That's the first time I've gotten that treatment where my face is on somebody else, and I end up looking like one of my idols, Borat.
The Elijah Campbell fan club continues to grow today. That's what we're here about on the show.
There are dozens.
Explain the haunted house.
You live in a haunted house?
Yeah, well, it's just, my house is really old, and I live right next to Stones River Battlefield, basically on it.
Okay.
So there's a lot of history in that part of Murfreesboro where I live.
And yes, there is.
My Xbox has a thing where it likes to turn itself on and off at like 2 or 3 in the morning when I'm trying to sleep. So that's happened a couple times. And one time, it's all stemmed from like a text message I got from a roommate, too, as I was starting Darren Donick and Chase one day, where I'm here in the producer chair, right? And I get a text from one of my roommates. He's like, "How long have you been gone?" And I was like, "I've been gone for a couple of hours, man. What's up?" He goes, I heard someone going up and down the steps, and Lucas, who's my younger brother, who also lives upstairs with me, was downstairs. He's like, "I thought it was you getting ready, and then I got out of the car to go to class and saw your car wasn't here, and I'm really freaked out."
Wow.
No
kidding. How about that?
This could be like Poltergeist.
I've been waiting.
Don't go to the light. Don't go to the TV.
So when it turns itself on, I need to stay. I need to stay away. Stay away from the TV whenever it starts turning itself on and off.
Yes.
So,
wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, Darren is obsessed with that fact. He'll ask me about it every now and then. It has reached a point of fascination on Darren Donick and Chase. So
wow.
Well, keep us updated whenever you know the hauntings continue.
Yes. Yeah, well, if I ever go missing, you know where to look, and that's inside my TV, and then it's
this is
what the fourth Poltergeist movie will take place there.
Yeah. We'll root for you from afar.
Stay away. Thanks to Michael Rothstein for joining us in the last segment. What did you think there of his analysis on Arthur Smith? It is funny. I saw a little bit of his press conference yesterday answering all these questions about Julio Jones, and, you know, Arthur Smith is fine. He's friend of the show, Arthur Smith, and like he's going to do, I think, a really good job in Atlanta as a head coach. But you can kind of tell already that the Julio Jones stuff starting to annoy Arthur Smith at this point.
Yeah, understandably so. Yeah. But part of the job, part of the deal. Arthur Smith, someone who I would say, you know, he does fine. I don't think he loves that aspect of the job.
No.
I don't know that a ton of coaches do. But I suppose, you know, you're a new coach in the NFL. You're probably taking over a bad team. There's probably going to be some personnel stuff, and you know, there's stuff like that's probably going to come with it. But this is quite a bit of stuff for him early in his tenure. You know, there's just so much upheaval there, or potential upheaval.
Yeah, and I'm interested too. Like, that's why I asked Michael about, you know, Matt Ryan, because we talked about this heading into the draft for the Falcons. You're picking number four overall, and we knew quarterbacks were going top three, and that left kind of an interesting decision for Arthur Smith and the Falcons. Like, do you try to draft your quarterback of the future and maybe let it ride with Matt Ryan one more year and then move in a different direction? Or do you take the best player available on the board, which is Kyle Pitts? Obviously, we know what happened. They took Kyle Pitts. I don't know. Like, what do you think their confidence level is in Matt Ryan? And if I'm Arthur Smith, like, that's part of the reason you take the job is the offense there, and you feel like you can do really good things with it. Even without Julio Jones, I mean, Calvin Ridley, Gage is there. You think you know what you have in Kyle Pitts. That's a pretty dynamic athlete at this point. Like, to me, the story in Atlanta kind of continues to be the same, even if Julio Jones isn't there, is where you still have an offense that you feel pretty good about. That defense, you talk about challenges. Dean Pease has got a challenge on his hands heading to that defense in Atlanta.
Yeah, absolutely. That needs the most work. And that's, again, why when this trade stuff, I think certainly they understand and realistic about where they are. But keeping Matt Ryan and not doing the quarterback thing, I kind of still read as a view that maybe they're not in this multi-year rebuild mode. And, you know, if that's the case, that's where a trade, if you're a potential trade partner, maybe a veteran going back is attractive. You know, we talk about the picks, but if they get someone who could help that defense right now, yep, on the field, you know, I'm sure Dean Pease would not mind that. And the hard part is finding exactly who that is. But most people are talking about picks here. Again, go back to Jeff Schultz when we had him on. I mean, his reporting kind of led him to believing that, you know, yeah, they want to move that 15-3 or whatever it is, 15-5 off the cap this year, but they're willing to take some back,
yeah,
if it means, you know, a football player who can help their defense, especially their defense, or a running back, which is the one thing that offense does kind of lack. They don't have that guy. And look, when the Falcons were great, they at times had two guys,
yeah,
who were playing at a high level at that position. That's one big difference between now and then with the Falcons.
When we come back, we will switch gears. Vanderbilt baseball, being the number four national seed heading into the NCAA tournament, they're playing against Presbyterian coming up on Friday at 6 o'clock. Our very own Max Hurst will join us all over Vanderbilt baseball, all over Vanderbilt sports in general. We'll get to that coming up next. This is Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in. Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Elijah Campbell here with you on this Thursday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. Vanderbilt, the Vandy boys, hosting the regional once again. Nashville regional coming up this weekend. They get underway on Friday against Presbyterian. And to help us talk more about that, we go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and bring in our very own Max Hurst, host of the Anchor Down podcast, also a producer here at 102.5 The Game as well, and with the SEC Network. Max, is there any place you don't work for? What's going on, man? How we doing?
Hey, I can say the same for you at times, Robbie. So
that's true.
The love.
Absolutely. Max, you're as plugged in with this team as anybody. As you kind of look at the journey that it took to get to this point for Tim Corbin and company, you finished the season. Obviously, Vanderbilt, another very successful season, 40-15, the number one seed in this regional. What's the journey been like to get to this point? And as you look at this roster, what do you think the outlook is for this Vanderbilt team as they begin regional play starting this weekend?
Yeah, kind of from January, Corbin was playing down the team as inexperienced, which I never really agreed with, just because everybody's inexperienced because nobody played conference games last year. So his point was that even most of the best players on the team, many of whom were proven last year, like Jack Leiter and Carter Young, had never played a conference game. But to me, that didn't really mean much just because you knew these guys were going to produce, and it's played out that way. They've moved around the lineup a lot, more so because of injuries along the way than because of performance. But I feel like as long as Carter Young is back, which I would expect him to be at least in some capacity this weekend, going to give it a try, I would say they got a group of nine that they really like. They've obviously got two of the best starting pitchers in all of college baseball, which has had eyes on them all season long, and for Kamar Rocker the last three seasons. So this is not only the last go through the postseason for both of those guys, it's also their only go through the postseason together. So I think Leiter and Rocker will be in the spotlight as usual, but I mean, this is a Vandy team, especially with the draw they have. I think they got a pretty favorable draw, both in the regional and in a potential super. So I expect them to be a favorite to get to Omaha right now, without a doubt.
So, Max, down the stretch here, first of all, you mentioned Carter Young. I mean, certainly he's been out for a few weeks. That's a huge loss in the lineup and in the field. But the lineup's kind of been up and down. And then, of course, the bullpen has not been as deep. Maybe Ethan Smith, though, is another guy who maybe makes a difference. If you could fix one of those two things, you know, in terms of you know, offense or bullpen, what do you think is more important? What do you think is more realistic?
Well, I think offense is more important. I think there is more of a built-in fix to the issues that there have been with the bullpen, with just how the coaching staff will manage in the postseason. They manage differently with their pitching selections in the regular season than they do in the playoffs. In a playoff game or in an elimination game, which they may not get to this weekend, but they have a chance to go undefeated, which they did 2 years ago and never even face elimination in a regional. But if you get to an elimination game, they're not going to manage that like they managed the Sunday game at Ole Miss 3 weeks ago when Hunter Owen came in the third inning for Pat Riley and gave up a 10-run inning. In a situation like that, they would likely go to either Nick Maldonado or Luke Murphy, who are by far their two best relievers this season throughout the year. So I think the management of the game kind of fixes whatever bullpen issues there have been. Because you got to remember, in 2019 in Omaha, in six games, only three relievers pitched when Vanderbilt had the lead: Tyler Brown, Jake Eater, and Zach King. Other than that, everybody else who came out of the bullpen came in when Vanderbilt was trailing. So they're only going to go to the premium guys when protecting a lead. So I think that will help those issues, while they have others along the way to throw in lefty matchup situations like Hugh Fisher or somebody like Nelson Berkowitz, who can pitch while the team is trailing. But I think those three this year will be Chris McElvain and then Maldonado and Murphy. And hopefully Ethan Smith is available this weekend too. I don't think it would be for more than an inning at a time if he is, but I think he's out there. So with that in mind, I think the offense is more important to make sure is right this weekend. But over the course of the season, they haven't really had back-to-back games where they didn't hit and it cost them a game. I mean, they've had low-scoring wins, but they found ways to score enough, I mean, at least every other game, even if they have an off night. And I think Young being back would be a big part of that, even if he probably isn't 100%.
The great Max Herz on the line with us, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Max, look, it's one thing in the regular season to have that Friday-Saturday rotation of Rocker and Leiter. How much more are those two and that strength for this team amplified when you get to this time of the year once regional play begins?
Yeah, this is a sport in college baseball specifically. Baseball at large is kind of this way, but the way the college baseball postseason is structured, if you can win two out of three, four times, you win the national championship. You have to win three to win a regional, but if you win the first two, it makes it pretty easy to get that last one in a couple of cracks, at least in Vanderbilt's experience. Then a super is a true two out of three. Then in the College World Series, it's those exact same two formats over again. So with those two guys as the front two, I mean, if you get both of them to win, you're a win or two away from a national championship right there. And obviously, you can't expect them to win every start. We saw that down the stretch. Neither of them were going as deep in games, but I think they'll be able to go deeper this weekend with everything on the line. But I think with the ball in those guys' hands, their last go-around at this, I think it plays into how you win a title perfectly, both on paper and on the field. So they've almost, those two guys alone, got the whole format of this sport mastered.
How do you feel about them individually right now? Seems like Rocker has been pretty, you know, stable and solid. Obviously, Leiter was just absolutely on fire, had some hard times, skipped a start. How would you evaluate them individually at this moment?
Yeah, I think they both had a dip along the way. Rocker's was a little earlier than Leiter's, and they've both come back from it. So Rocker had a three-start stretch in, I believe, the second, third, and fourth weeks of SEC play, really just the second and the third week, where his velocity was down like 4 or 5 miles an hour. And I just asked him about it because it became a big story in the MLB draft world, and he was falling from second and third overall to as far as seventh and eighth overall, and he really hasn't moved back up, which is odd to me. So I just asked him about it because it became this big story, and he said it's kind of a normal midseason hump to have to get over. These guys start throwing like right after New Year's. That is early in the year, especially with how little they threw last year in game action and how different the calendar was, and guys in the fall season didn't know when exactly to start or stop throwing along the way. So there were a lot of challenges, and Rocker's velocity just went down. He said it was a midseason hump that he had to get over. He was confident that it would get back. He says it didn't dip as much as kind of the MLB draft writers of the world said it did, and he has more metrics than they do, so I, even though he's biased, will at least partially trust him on that one, that it didn't drop fastball into the 89-90 range. I mean, it was still a little bit 91-92, which is fine compared to his usual 93-94-95, but the thing that stands out to me, having followed his whole career, is the last 2 years, basically the same thing happened to him at that same point of the season. In both years, he had to miss a start. This year, he didn't miss a start. So he just kept on pitching through it, and even though his velocity was down, to me, that's a win, that he shows that he can pitch through that and still win a couple of those games, too. So that's well behind him. His velocity has been back up. Last week, the control wasn't great. But other than that, he's been solid the last few starts. On the lighter side, talking with Tim Corbin and especially Scott Brown, the pitching coach, they are really happy with the decision to sit him out for a week against Alabama. They think the decision worked. We've seen it with him. I mean, same as Rocker coming back from the velocity drop. He's been back to normal in terms of stuff these last few weeks. And they like the decision to do it. The thing that they saw on his, I don't know if, I guess, underlying metrics is the right word, but statistics that they keep internally that aren't really publicly kept, his whiff rate was way down. He was getting way fewer swings and misses, especially on his fastball. And like you said, Joe, that's what he was doing earlier in the season. He was blowing guys away. That's what he was doing in the no-hitter. And the fastball had kind of lost its life in its late run, and a week off seems to have gotten it back. So I think that's a win for the coaching staff, who, I mean, he threw a lot of pitches in the no-hitter earlier. Who knows what causes what, but I think that's a win for them in that decision, and they've got him for the games that matter most. Just like I said, they manage these games differently. All eyes are on winning in the playoffs.
You're absolutely right. And Vanderbilt's, I guess, their title defense gets underway from 2019 defending national champions on Friday night against Presbyterian. Everything gets started in postseason play for Vanderbilt. The great Max Hurst has been our guest here on Robbie and Rex Road, the Anchor Down podcast, a producer here on 102.5 The Game, does work for the SEC Network as well. Max, great stuff as always, brother. Appreciate you taking time to join us this morning.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Probably 3 or 4 o'clock today, we got the big regional preview podcast coming out, talking about all three teams coming in. So that'll be on the Anchor Down podcast later today.
Absolutely. Nice. Make sure you check that out later. Max does a great job here at ESPN 102.5 The Game. When we come back, we'll react a little bit to what Max had to say there. Look ahead to this contest this weekend coming up for Vanderbilt. Also, get back to your thoughts on our text line as well, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, 615-737-1025, 615-737-1025. This is Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Elijah Campbell here with you on this Thursday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks to Max Hurst for joining us in the last segment. Vanderbilt getting regional play underway this weekend. Their first game against Presbyterian coming up on Friday. Joe, I was telling you during the break, like, obviously Vanderbilt had another great season. They're the number 4 seed nationally heading into this tournament, and they're right there in the thick of things in terms of competing for a national championship. I feel like, though, this time of year, with the format being what it is, the rest that they've gotten kind of heading into this, that Rocker and Leiter specifically could just blow through people in the regional and super regional right into Omaha. Like, it just kind of feels like those two single-handedly could give up like a combined 2 runs in the next couple of rounds as they head into Omaha.
Well, certainly, you know, if you can get to like the super, this is where it's such a, it's a 2 out of 3. And it's of course, if you got to the final series, it'd be the same thing. That would be very tough to do, I still think, for Vanderbilt. But 2 out of 3 format, man, you feel good about those guys. there is a lot of pressure on him, but of course Rocker has already demonstrated 2 years ago. He rises to the occasion in those moments. Leiter is interesting. I mean, he is just a sophomore. This is his first taste of all this stuff. He was so filthy early in the year. I mean, it was ridiculous. And some of these things are to be expected, hitting the wall. I mean, in any sport, you know, as a first time going through this level of play, and that league is just, I mean, there's, you know, there's pros on every team that you're pitching to, that you're trying to get out. So, I mean, it's not all that surprising, everything that's gone on, but it does give you a little bit of, okay, wait and see on Leiter and how he handles this whole thing. By the way, since we're talking about Vanderbilt baseball, I will quickly promote the story I wrote today on Tim Corbin's time at Presbyterian.
Please do.
Some stories I had not heard. I'll share one. Like, so, you know, Maggie Corbin, his wife, now of almost 25 years, like, she was 8 months pregnant. She was, you know, she was previously married. They met. They were friends. He played her in tennis. She was 8 months pregnant, and he constantly hit drop shots to an 8 months pregnant woman. Jeez. To beat her. And I have a quote in the story. It's like, yeah, I did that. I wanted to win.
Jeez.
Now, she was a three-time All-American at the College of Charleston. So, okay. I mean, it's – but still, I mean
– that's intense.
Drop-shotting just all day. Wow. So, I mean, some good stuff there. I mean, the Presbyterian, it's really quite a full-circle thing that they're coming here Friday. Elton Pollock, who does have media today, but I talked to him yesterday as they were riding the bus in to Nashville, you know, one of – Corbin's great players at Presbyterian, now has him in the NCAA tournament for the first time. They get to play Corbin. Pretty cool story.
It is a cool story. I brought this up, I think, before with Tim Corbin. But, you know, there's that saying out there in sports, like, I hate to lose much more than I enjoy winning. Like, to me, the guy that embodies that the most is Tim Corbin. Like, look, they win a lot, obviously. And when they win a national championship, he's happy. So I'm not going to sit here and act like he's not. But to me, like, whenever they lose a game or lose a series, it is pretty funny at times to watch how just upset Tim Corbin is. To me, he embodies the hating to lose.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, and I think most successful coaches and probably athletes, it's like the losses hurt more than the wins feel good.
Yeah.
So there's some normalcy there, but yes, I think he takes it to a different level. I mean, when I'm talking to Elton Pollock yesterday, so again, imagine that. And then imagine 35 years less of maturity.
Yeah.
And coaching Presbyterian College with a bunch of students you've recruited out of the student body to be on your team and going 4-20.
Yeah.
I was talking to Elton Pollock, and he basically just like laughed, like, yeah, no, he didn't like losing. You know? But certainly, I mean, there can't be any question. It's part of the formula.
Yeah.
For success here. There's no doubt.
I don't think there's any question about that. And Vanderbilt underway coming up on Friday against Presbyterian. Speaking of somebody that does not like to lose, Mike Krzyzewski, Duke coach. He's been there for a long time, 41 seasons with the Duke Blue Devils, announcing that this upcoming season will be his last. Mike Krzyzewski will be retiring after the 21-22 season at the University of Duke. Obviously, Joe, a legend, an icon in college basketball, and basketball as a whole, has done some work with the USA national team as well. So, I mean, we all know who Coach K is. We all know how good of a coach he is. Just your initial reaction to Coach K calling it quits after this year, calling it a career with one more run coming up with the Duke Blue Devils.
Yeah, it's a huge story. And the most surprising thing to me is that apparently John Shire has already been chosen to be his successor.
Yeah.
I mean, that one kind of hit me out of left field. I'm like, gosh, I remember calling John Shire when Michigan State was trying to recruit him out of Chicago. He was a kid. This was like, wasn't this like 4 years ago? but that was surprising to me. I guess it's not surprising that they would go in-house with it. I mean, you've got a ton of options, but for that to already be sort of set up is interesting. And, you know, for Duke's perspective, it's like you want this to be seamless. You want to transition. I think Krzyzewski, I think this represents, we're going to see more of this. We just saw Roy Williams retire. Yep. I think, and this was stated yesterday in some of the coverage of this, you know, the portal, name, image, likeness, all these things. I mean, you're going to see, I think, a lot of these old guard coaches, including a guy I think I covered for a long time, who I don't think is too far away. That's just me speculating, but I don't think so. Maybe Jim Boeheim will coach till he's 97. I don't know. But,
might.
But Krzyzewski, love him, hate him. I mean, I don't think you can deny his greatness. I think my biggest beef with the whole Krzyzewski narrative is that, like, Duke does it differently than the other big-time programs that win at this level with that kind of talent. I mean, it's a little bit ridiculous. But look, that's how the game is played. He played it how the game is played. I think you have a strong case that he's the best coach ever. A lot of people would still say John Wooden, but I think it's probably between those two, right?
I would agree.
Can't think of another another coach that's got that kind of resume.
Well, and when we talk about – so I hesitate to even introduce these words because I know this is talk radio, a poison. But if you did a Mount Rushmore.
Oh, God.
I know.
Oh, I just threw it off.
I know. But yeah, it was interesting. If you had Krzyzewski and Wooden, I mean, would Pat Summitt and Gino Auriemma be the other two?
They might be.
Yeah. I mean, really, what other, I guess, in men's basketball outside of, I guess, Kay and Wooden have the accolades that Summitt and Gino do?
Now, you can talk about beyond just, what about people who brought social change? I mean, yep. John Thompson is a name that I think is... is definitely worth mentioning there. You know, there's more to it than just, like, let's add up your rings and your hardware.
Dean Smith.
But, yeah, I mean, right. Dean Smith, there's people who would argue. Now, he had the knock on him forever. Oh, can't win the big one, until Michael Jordan and Worthy and those guys got him in 82. But how many championships did Dean Smith end up with?
That's a good question.
Just the one?
No, because they won the Chris Webber timeout game.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. 11 years later. So two, but I mean, that's not – but hey, I mean,
yeah,
there is more to it. Consistent excellence, counts for something. But Krzyzewski finished the deal 5 times. That's a big deal. Wooden finished it, 10? But he also, it was in a small field of the tournament, and he's out west every year. Like, they're playing, UCSB and, Wyoming to get to the Final Four.
Yeah.
So I'm not knocking John Wooden, but
kinda
I'm just
sounds
saying.
Sounds like you were.
Well, I'm just saying it was a little. It was easier than the way the tournament was set up to constantly get there. Now, if you have Bill Walton and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you're going to get there anyway.
Yes,
we can all agree on that.
I would say so.
That certainly helps.
Yeah,
Elijah, your reaction to Coach K calling it quits
just feels weird. It's going to be really weird imagining a college basketball season without Roy Williams and Coach K in it. I mean, especially just for me. I mean, I've been watching college basketball since I was 6 years old. So we're talking 2001 on, and that was the biggest names in college basketball. Coach K was one of them. I'm at least glad I can say that I went to a Duke basketball game and saw him coach in person in a 114-55 blowout over Pennsylvania.
Nice.
Yeah. Denzel Washington was in the house. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah, and I got to be a Cameron Crazy for a night because I got a student ticket.
There you go.
So that was an experience.
If you were a Cameron Crazy, then you may have noticed Press Row and how the Cameron Crazies are committing felonies rubbed up against reporters and spitting on their necks and editing their stories.
Oh, yeah. There is no space. There is no room for a bubble.
During the game?
And actually, my coworker, my columnist, this literally happened. One of the Cameron Crazies actually was like, I wish I could remember the word, but you misspelled,
so-and-so.
There, that's the wrong usage of there. Something like that.
That's the most Duke thing I've ever heard.
Yes, and he was like, oh, thanks. And I was like, this is amazing. And if I had to do this for a whole year, I'd quit.
Yeah.
But it's amazing once every couple of years.
Congratulations to Coach K on a great career. We'll see what Duke's able to do in his last season coming up in 21-22. A bit of a farewell tour for Coach K coming up.
A lot of rocking chairs on the way.
We'll see how much of a blue blood they are with another coach in there.
When we come back, we'll get back into the Nashville Predators. Also, some thoughts on the text line, including one Joe Rexrode really wants to get to coming up next as well. 615-737-1025, 615-737-1025. This is Robbie and Rexrode live from the Wholesale Link Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.